And welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Stephen Ussery, and I'm delighted to welcome Ariel Lahan to the program today. Ariel is a historical novelist based outside of Nashville, Tennessee. Her debut was The Wife, The Maid, and The Mistress, about a New York Supreme Court justice who disappeared in 1930. Flight of Dreams was about the last voyage of the Hindenburg. And today we'll be talking about her latest novel, I Was Anastasia, about a woman believed by many to be the sole survivor of Tsar Nicholas II's family, Anastasia Romanoff. Ariel, in your author's note at the end of the book, you mentioned that you didn't set out to write I Was Anastasia. How did the story force its way into your life?
Force is a good word. This was about 3 years ago, actually, and I was set to write a book about Alcatraz. It was a Friday afternoon. I had all of my research material. I had the entire novel plotted, and I was wasting time on the internet one day, and I stumbled across this small tidbit of history in which a woman was found floating in a canal in Berlin. And as I read this article, it talked about how she was pulled from this canal, taken to the hospital, and an examination was performed. And they found countless really horrific scars that seemed to be consistent with bullets and bayonets. And it was about 2 years later that she first claimed to be Anastasia Romanoff. And as we know from history, bullets and bayonets are what was used to kill the imperial family in 1918, 100 years ago, this year.
Well, since this has happened to you, have you taken that as a lesson to stay on task, or are you happy for the diversion?
A little bit of both. Sometimes I think that Alcatraz would have been easier to write. It would not have been as excruciating for many reasons. But I also learned that sometimes there's room in life for surprises. And I've been writing long enough to know that every book changes you as a writer. It kind of reorganizes your writer DNA, so to speak. And I believe that I'm a different writer for having written Anastasia than I would have been had I written Alcatraz. So I'm happy I went with this one.
And I mean, it's a somewhat similar theme. We have Alcatraz and the prison there, mm-hmm. and then the Romanoff family being imprisoned after the revolution.
Yes. Yeah. Actually, I think you're the first. I don't know that I had stopped to think about that at all, but yes, the Romanoff family, starting in March of 1917, when the revolution spilled onto the palace grounds, they were first put under house arrest, and they remained there for 6 months. And then they were taken by train to a town in far eastern Russia, the far, far, far marshes of Russia, called Tobolsk. And they stayed there for almost a year. It was more than house arrest at that point. I mean, their world really did shrink. They had their house and they had a small yard. They couldn't do anything else. Boredom set in quite badly for the family at that point. And then at the very end of their captivity, they were taken once again from Tobolsk to a town called Ekaterinburg in Siberia. And that is where their story ends.
And that's essentially due north of like the Iranian-Afghani border.
Yes, it's cold and it's miserable and it's barren.
In the middle of nowhere.
Yes. There was no way for them to be found or rescued at that point.
Now, where did Anastasia fit in the birth order in the family?
She was the fourth child born. She was the fourth daughter. There was a son. The family finally had a son after her. His name was Alexei. They got their heir, but he was hemophiliac from birth, and so it was not expected to live long, even though he was destined to rule the dynasty. But Anastasia was right there kind of toward the end. Her birth was a great disappointment to her parents and to her country in general. Everyone had waited impatiently for their royal heir, and they got another daughter.
Do you think that treatment altered her personality or
influenced it? I joke now when I talk to people about the book. I tell them that this is not their Disney princess. Fox made the animated movie in 1996. And people kind of associate her with that cartoon, when in reality she was a little bit of a brat. She was really talkative. She was really goofy. She loved practical jokes, a little bit bawdy. She loved dirty jokes and causing trouble, not typically what you think of for an imperial princess.
Now, she had a nickname in the family, Shwibsik.
Shwibsik, little imp is
little
what
imp.
It means in Russian. Really, during their time in captivity, according to all of the biographies that I read, Anastasia was the one that kept them entertained. She kept their spirits high. She kept them laughing. She kept them living through a time when they were tempted just to give up completely. But she was an imp. She was known for climbing trees and getting sap stuck in her hair and skinning her knees and tearing her clothes and running around with knotted hair instead of pinafores and frocks.
Now, you had mentioned her brother's hemophilia, which mm-hmm. came through her mother's side of the family, mm-hmm. and her mother had quite a regal heritage herself.
Yes, her mother's grandmother was Queen Victoria of England, born and bred a princess. It was the only thing she'd ever known, and of course, she then marries the Tsar, or the soon-to-be Tsar of Russia. He was coronated shortly after their marriage. She, Alexandra, never knew anything but a royal, prestigious, decadent life.
She was not exactly well-loved by her subjects in Russia.
She was not, nor was she the wisest woman who's ever lived. She had a notorious association with a man named Grigory Rasputin. They called him the heretic monk, and he really did shape her approach to the royal family, her approach to ruling, and her people hated her for it. He mired her in scandal and in rumor, and there were many things that went wrong at the end of the Romanov dynasty, but he played a large part in her particular downfall.
Most of the book, I would say probably 60% to two-thirds, is from the viewpoint of Anna Anderson, mm-hmm. who we don't know if she is or isn't Anastasia through the course of the book. Now, mm-hmm. of course, we could consult the historical record and find out, but
yes,
we'll not ruin that for people.
Yes. She is the woman who claimed to be Anna Anderson for 50 plus years.
But there were quite a few other people who claimed to be members of the family, including Anastasia. In your research, were there any other notable people who made claims out there?
There were. I joke that writing about the Romanovs is sort of like playing with a bag of feral cats. There's so much information, and you can spend your whole life reading nothing but the Romanovs. And for me, with this particular book, I reached a point where I realized I had to concentrate all of my energy and all of my time on these two individuals, or I would never get to the point of writing the novel itself. So I didn't, to be honest with you, I didn't spend a whole lot of time researching any of the other claimants or their reasons for trying to claim her identity. I focused on the woman known as Anna Anderson because she was the longest and most convincing and most well-known.
The book begins with a warning mm-hmm. from the woman known as Anna Anderson.
Yes.
What is she warning the reader of?
She is telling the reader, basically, that she will answer their questions. She will tell them whether or not she is, in fact, Anastasia, but she does not believe they are strong or brave enough to handle the information she is about to impart to them.
Now, we have two different timelines in the mm-hmm. book. There's one of the Romanov family beginning just right before the abdication of Tsar Nicholas II, moving forward about a year and a half. And then we have about 50 years of Anna Anderson's life moving in reverse chronological order.
Yes.
From 1970. Why did you choose that approach?
Well, I mean, the short answer is it was the structure that was right for this particular story. The longer answer is, as you know, there's a moment when the two storylines collide, when the two tales kind of merge and become one, so to speak. And I needed them to happen simultaneously. I needed them to really run into one another. And the only way to do that in print was to tell one chronologically and one in reverse and have them meet right there in the middle. And it's that meeting that answers definitively for the reader whether or not Anna Anderson is, in fact, Anastasia Romanov.
What was the challenge you had in balancing the two stories, since the one coming at the time of the revolution is such compressed in a matter of time, as opposed to a more expansive story that takes place over the course of 50 years? How do you balance those two?
With great difficulty. It was a huge challenge. One, I liked personally. I love the challenge. I love putting a book together the way that you would put a puzzle together. But we're talking about a shorter amount of time and then decades and decades and decades. So I had to choose important moments from Anna Anderson's life. I had to very carefully look at all of the events during those 50 years and find the ones that most closely related to the overall story. And I did that by weaving in characters, not characters, they were real people, but the people that knew Anastasia well were also the people in that knew Anna Anderson well. And I used them as sort of the connective tissue between the two stories.
There is one person that plays a big role mm-hmm. in both timelines, Gleb Botkin. Mm-hmm. And we should all be so lucky to have a Gleb in our life.
Oh, my goodness. Yes, he was the most loyal friend to Anastasia Romanov. And he was the most loyal supporter of Anna Anderson. And his belief in Anna Anderson is one of the main reasons that so many people truly believe she was Anastasia Romanov. But he was the son of Eugene Botkin, who was the Romanov family doctor. Gleb Botkin grew up with Anastasia, and he was one of the first people to find Anna when she came out of that institution after being hospitalized. And he looked at her, and he saw her, and he said, "That is Anastasia." And he spent his whole life trying to prove that she was, in fact, Anastasia Romanov.
But there was always something in her that kept her from Gleb. Was it the assumption of royalty and one must have a remove from their servants?
Yeah, and there is, and if this is true, according to the historical record, people always ask me, shouldn't that have been the man that Anna Anderson fell in love with and spent her life with? And the answer is probably so. But time and distance did constantly pull them apart. And there was a sense, I believe, primarily on Gleb's side, that was his monarch. He couldn't pursue her the way he might a normal woman. And I believe a huge part of it was him keeping his distance. And then time went on and they aged and they grew apart and it happens.
But as a young person at the time of the revolution, mm-hmm. he was quite smitten with her.
He was absolutely smitten with Anastasia. He was very sweet to her. He would constantly bring her little trinkets and toys. And he was a little bit younger. And so there was an element where it was kind of puppy love. And Anastasia was old enough to where she didn't want puppy love. She wanted real love. And Anastasia kind of kept him at arm's length.
Now, we mentioned how the influence of Grigori Rasputin mm-hmm. was not a positive thing for her mother, mm-hmm. and the Rasputin family cannot quite let go of tormenting the proposed Romanov family
they
afterwards.
They cannot, no. And Grigori's daughter, Maria, found Anna Anderson a number of times, came to visit her, made sure that their pictures were taken together, put in the papers. It was a thorn in Anna Anderson's side for the rest of her life.
This is the time before DNA mm-hmm. testing. How, with lack of physical proof on her side, how did Anna Anderson further her claims of being Anastasia?
Yeah, it's a great question. I was discussing this with someone recently. If you live in a time where you don't have your picture taken every 5 minutes from birth, where there's no facial recognition programs, where there's no DNA science, where there's no technology available to help you definitively prove that you are who you say you are, how do you do that? And it's interesting because we look at this story through hindsight. We look at it and go, oh, why would people believe this? Or why wouldn't they believe this? But all they had in front of them was a woman who had these really horrific scars, who had a very striking resemblance to Anastasia, and who claimed to be her. She knew many of the small secret things about the family. She had insider information, you could say. She knew the things they did on vacation. Many of the Romanov family friends supported her claims. A handful of the relatives supported her claims, but there were just as many who didn't. And if you look at that particular time frame, it's a very interesting thing to wonder what would have happened in Russia, in Europe, had Anna Anderson been proven to be Anastasia. The Bolsheviks were already in power. The revolution had already happened. Russia had taken on a whole new form of government. Vladimir Lenin was already in control. But you have a girl who claims to be the only surviving member of the imperial family left. It would have turned everything on its ear. There were a lot of people who had a lot of reasons to keep her quiet and to make sure that her claims were never proven.
there was really no chance for her to regain power in Russia after the Soviets had taken control. But there was a lot of money still available in the Romanov
family.
There
was money and there was loyalty. And money and loyalty and hope. I think we forget the thing. She opened the door, not just to Russian culture or European culture, but worldwide culture. She cracked open the door and provided hope that one of them survived, that there was the possibility of a happy ending, that this tragedy could have maybe been averted for one of them. And people latch on to that. Hope is powerful. Loyalty is powerful. Money is powerful. She would have been a very forceful figure had she been able to definitively prove.
Now, also in your author's note, you talk about you're not the biggest fan of royalty and aristocracy. So how much was a challenge for you in writing the period during the revolution to give a sense of feeling and empathy toward these people who had not been good rulers at all for the people of Russia?
Yeah, I think part of it is we live in a celebrity-obsessed culture, and I find it just personally baffling. We are so obsessed with the bright, the shiny, the beautiful, the wealthy, that we completely disregard all of the other stories available to us. But approaching the story from that standpoint was actually, I think, a benefit for me, because instead of beginning the story at a point when they were living in opulence at the height of their power, I begin it at the moment that everything goes wrong. And so we're able to chronicle them going from great privilege to farming their own potatoes in the yard. And there's one scene in particular where Anastasia is being punished for something and she's got to take a bucket of innards and go dump it on a trash heap in a yard. That is the last thing a Grand Duchess would have ever been required to do, but that is what their circumstances brought them to.
And for our younger listeners who've never seen Dr. Zhivago or studied Russian history, the Russian Revolution was not this neat thing that happened quickly. There were a lot of reversals of fortune amongst the, I think, three major factions who were fighting for power after the Tsar was overthrown. So that is where most of the uncertainty in the Romanov line seems to come from after the revolution.
Yes, it was this long, bitter, miserable, excruciating period for Russians in general. It wasn't quick. It wasn't easy. And the culture at that time, they looked at their monarchs. They wanted a leader, and what they got was chaos instead. And so, of course, they were looking for one of them, hoping for one of them to have made it out.
You start Anna Anderson's story in 1970, but she had passed away in 1984. Why didn't you pick 1970?
I picked that moment in 1970 because it was the 50th anniversary of the day that she jumped off the Bindler Bridge in Berlin. And it was after she jumped off that bridge that she was found floating in that canal. But it was also the day, the 50th anniversary, coincidentally, was also the day that the courts in Hamburg, Germany, finally made their ruling. And she got the phone call at her home in Charlottesville about their verdict that night. And I just thought it was very fitting to give her around 50 years. And I thought that particular date was really symbolic.
Why did the court in Hamburg was the venue for ruling on this?
Lichtenberg, he filed it for her in Germany. That's where she was living at the time. She could not go to Russia. It was too dangerous. And for her to come out in Russia as a claimant to the throne would have been incredibly dangerous for her. So they made the claim, or they filed in Germany. And it was on that date, 50 years after she jumped off the bridge, that the appeal, because they'd filed it, there'd been the trial, they made the verdict, they appealed the verdict, and then she got the answer to her appeal on that night.
Now, she was living, as you said, in Charlottesville, Virginia at the time, and she married an eccentric professor named Dr. Manahan. Give us a little background on him. Why would a professor in Virginia marry the woman claiming to be Anastasia
Romanoff? He was an enthusiast. He loved genealogy, and he was a friend of Gleb Botkin. They were friends, and when Anna Anderson found herself in a bit of trouble in Germany where she was living, he offered to pay for her to come to the United States, offered to pay for her visit, and then she got there, and I believe she had a three-month tourist visa, and her tourist visa was about to be up. She'd run out of sponsors, she had run out of friends, and rather than send her back to Germany, where she had just suffered a great loss and quite a bit of trauma, he offered to marry her. It was not a romantic arrangement so much as a legal arrangement that would allow her to stay in the United States. And he was determined to prove her as Anastasia Romanov. It's what he worked for the rest of his life, not just the rest of hers. He lived longer than she did. He wanted to help her. He wanted to be the one that finally got it written in ink that this was Anastasia Romanov.
And were there any other major happenings in her life after 1970 that we don't see in the book?
There were a number. She had some health complications that sent her to the hospital. This comes into the story. It didn't fit with this my particular story here, but some DNA samples were taken during these surgeries. That comes in later once the remains of most of the Romanov family were found later. They were able to test the Romanov DNA against Anna Anderson's DNA, and they had it because of these health complications she'd had. But she kind of went a little senile. She was fond of collecting pets. She gathered pets. She and Gleb would travel around. He would go visit people, and she would sit in the car and wait. She was this really strange, eccentric, odd person. She's a legend in Charlottesville. If you go to Charlottesville today, people can point to where they lived and they will tell stories of just the random strange things she did in her older years after being married to Jack.
Well, and after having lived so many years of relying on the support of strangers and benefactors.
And being hounded by the media, one of the things that I didn't have room for in the novel is there is a time in which she lives in a cottage in the Black Forest. And over the course of 1 year, she got a visit from 250 different reporters. There was someone banging on her door every single day. She was receiving letters every single day from people. And I imagine decade after decade after decade after decade, how tired it would make you if you're just trying to prove who you are. And some people listen to you and some people don't. Other people want to use you. Other people want to mock you. That would wear any human down. And she became very reclusive and not a little strange in her old age.
I mean, she kept way too many animals there in Germany.
Way. She had 3 dogs and 60 cats. And she was lonely, I believe, and eccentric. And who wouldn't be if that's with the life you've lived, if that's the lot you've been handed?
In researching her, did the movie Anastasia with Ingrid Bergman bring all the stuff back up again? Had it died down for a while, or was that just a continuation all the way through?
It was a continuation all the way through, but I think what the Bergman movie did is it was the first official stamp of recognition, because the movie Anastasia is based in part on Anna Anderson's life and claims. It's fictionalized. They take liberties. They do any number of...
And it was a play first, wasn't it?
Yes, it was a play first. And then I believe it was 20th Century Fox, I think, bought the rights and made the movie. And Ingrid Bergman starred in it. And she won an Academy Award for Best Actress that year. It was a career-making movie for her, but it was the thing that put Anna Anderson in broad public awareness.
Was there like actual information about the meeting, what they talked about?
There's very little. There's reference that they did meet. There are no details about what they actually talked about. That meeting was fictional. That was a recreation on my part, but I was very intrigued by the idea that they had met.
Now, recently you had tweeted something about having 3 trustworthy sources, but they all put an occurrence on a different date.
Yes.
And just thinking, with a confusing story such as this one, with so many different people arguing so many different points, in researching that, how do you determine what the truth and what fact might be?
It becomes impossible. That tweet actually is for the novel that I'm working on now. It wasn't for Anastasia, but I ran into the same problem with Anastasia. Every biographer will list different dates, and sometimes it's minutia, little stuff, but sometimes it's big stuff. And after a while, it becomes really difficult to know which one is accurate. And so when there are inconsistencies like that, I will choose the one that fits the story that I am telling the most. Because at the end of the day, I'm writing a novel. And I hope everyone reads a novel knowing that it is fiction, that there is a good bit made up. And I try in my author's notes to be very clear about what I have made up and what is fact. But there always comes a point in every novel where you have to set it aside and go, okay, what serves this story the best? And then you go with that and do your best to explain it later. It's impossible with a subject like this to get every single tiny little thing correct.
But with your role as a historical novelist, at what point do you think license is okay and when do you think it's going too far?
For me, the rule that I keep for myself is if it can be established historically, I will stick with it 100%. The only license that I take in this novel had to do with names. There were so many. There was a cast of hundreds in the real story. And you can't have 150 characters in a novel. It's impossible for a reader to keep track of that many. So I did condense people. There was one situation, and this was a suggestion by my editor. The Romanov children actually had two tutors that went with them to Siberia. We only needed one. So I did trim out characters. I did, in a couple of instances, there was a Kablinsky and a Kerensky and all of these very similar Russian names. I did abbreviate or give people nicknames. A lot of people in this book, Anna Anderson in particular, gives nicknames to, just as a way to keep them straight in her own mind.
Is that something she actually did, called people by their positions?
I don't know. For me, it was a way also to help delineate her character from Anastasia's, to give them just a little bit of difference there, and a way, honestly, to help keep all of these names straight. When you're talking about 50 years worth of a person's life, you meet a lot of people over the course of 50 years. And so sometimes it's easier to refer to them as the chauffeur or the mailman versus Jim and Bob.
Or Alexander and Alexei.
Yes. Well, and the thing is, many of the people had the same name. They had the same first name. And it gets very tedious as a reader and it gets very complicated as a writer. So it was just a device used to keep things clear on the page.
I think you said there were three or four different Yakovs.
Mm-hmm. So many Yakovs. I have room for one.
And it's not Yakov Smirnov.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is your third novel, and so much of the action takes place in the early part of the 20th century in this book, and then your other books have, too, been in that time period. So what is it, that part of the century that draws you so much?
You know, I seem to have gotten stuck here, and I never intended it. I have one that takes place in 1930s New York. I have one that takes place in 1937 on the Hindenburg on its final voyage. So that actually only is 3.5 days. And then, of course, this book takes place, much of it, in 1918 in the early 20th century. I think for myself, I like it because it's definite historical fiction, but it's not so far in the past. I can still have people driving a car and listening to the radio. There comes a point when you go so far into the past that it's almost like science fiction or fantasy. You have to do entire world building to recreate ancient Italy or any time frame that really sucks you that far back. It requires a different skill set and it requires a different approach to creating the world around them. Whereas early 20th century is far enough in the past where, I don't know, like this story happened 100 years ago. That's quite a long ways, but people were still driving cars and there was electricity. That's helpful. If I don't have to have my characters, you know, lighting a fire in the fireplace just to stay warm, they can live a relatively modern life.
It's interesting because, I mean, as of all of the 20th century, technology played such a big role and things seemed to change so quickly over the course of the century, it would be kind of difficult to kind of keep up
with what's going on there. Difficult to keep up, and it's difficult to be accurate. I always have a slog when it comes to the copy edits because any good copy editor is very, very particular about what kind of radio you're using and does that window actually open. And I cannot tell you the number of times that I have had a copy editor say, well, actually, that date in that year did not fall on a Sunday. What that means for me is if I change it to a Monday, I have to completely rearrange my whole plot. It's like pulling a loose thread on a sweater. Everything else unravels. So you have to be detailed enough to make it feel accurate, but not so detailed that it pulls people out of the story. One of my books, I got hate mail for a year because I used polyester thread at a point.
It hadn't been created yet.
Well, it had.
Oh, but it wasn't in wide usage.
But people go to Google, and Google tells them that it had not.
Oh.
So, and then they will email me and educate me on on the timeline about polyester thread. So it's tricky. It's tricky to be detailed enough to pull a person in, but not so detailed that it yanks them out of the story and they go check and see if Altoids were invented.
Do you just ignore those emails when they come in, or do you have like a form letter saying thank you for your acknowledgement?
I read them all. The only ones I ignore are the ones that are mean. If they insult me or if they insult my editor or my ancestors, I tend to not answer those. But most people are genuinely being helpful, and I will often reply and say, thank you so much for this. I didn't know. We'll do our best to correct it for the paperback. And I let them know that, you know, as you can imagine, in a novel of this size and complexity, it is impossible to get every single thing right. And to a certain degree, I'm relying on my own research sources, which may or may not be accurate.
You mentioned earlier you were working on a book about Alcatraz and said you were working on something right now. Is that still Alcatraz, or have you moved on to another topic?
It is not currently Alcatraz. Ever since I let people know that I was working on Alcatraz, they're very eager for me to go back to that one. Apparently, there's a lot of demand for that. But my new one, I am actually not allowed to say what it's about yet.
Okay. With Russia being in the news so much, with international intrigue, is there anything in studying the revolution that gave you any insight on what's happening nowadays over there?
Maybe a little bit in reverse. I have read a number of articles lately about Vladimir Putin and his obsession with the Romanovs and the way that he follows that and the way that he has in many ways, I have read, I'm not an expert on Putin by any stretch, so maybe don't quote me here, but many of the current scholars believe that in many ways he is modeling his own regime after the Romanov dynasty. And I find that fascinating. It's 100 years later. I don't know that maybe the Romanovs were the best example on how to run a dynasty, but it's fascinating.
Well, Ariel, I want to thank you so much for stopping by today and sharing I Was Anastasio with us.
Thank you so much. It's been a great deal of fun.
Ariel Lahan is the author of the novel I Was Anastasia, which is published by Doubleday. I'm Stephen Usry, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is recorded in the studios of WIPL in Memphis, Tennessee. If you have any questions or comments, you can email us at WIPLFM@gmail.com or write to us at Book Talk, care of WIPL, 3030 Poplar Avenue, Memphis, Tennessee, 38111, or call us at 901-415-2752.
This recording of Book Talk is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 3.0 license for the United States. You are free to share, copy, distribute, or display and perform this work. But there are restrictions. Nothing in this license impairs or restricts WYPL's moral rights. Thank you for listening to Book Talk.